Welcome to another episode of Find Your Sustainability. My name is Lee Ball. Today we have joining us Brian Crutchfield, a longtime energy advocate. And I was really interested in getting Brian on the show because of the current state of energy in the world today. Brian worked with the Tennessee Valley Authority for many years. More recently, he worked with Blue Ridge Energy as their sustainable development director. Welcome, Brian, to the show.
Great to be here, Lee.
How did you first become interested in advocating for the environment?
Well, I was in grad school back during the original energy crisis, 73 and 74, when there were gas lines. OPEC had cut off the supply, sort of like they just recently did. Prices were high, and not only that, you couldn't get it. It was an odd, even day kind of thing, or according to your name, when you could get in line just to get gas. And at the time, I was in graduate school at Virginia Tech working on a degree in city and regional planning. Had a professor who really was into this type of thing and got us working with a group that was trying to bring coal back to Southwest Virginia. They were selling so much coal and shipping it out of Norfolk to Japan and other places that low-income folks couldn't buy it. And so we were bringing a carload back on like every return empty train just for local folks. It was pretty unusual. Sort of got into energy resource analysis at that time in 74, got my master's degree, did some work up in Washington, D.C. Basically, being in graduate school regarding planning, realizing that all of a sudden energy was a factor, that you couldn't necessarily predict what was happening in that field anymore. You need to start planning around energy issues, not just transportation and highways and development, because now the cost of energy was driving a lot of things in business and communities and society. So that was the beginning during the first crisis.
Going back a little before that, you grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Yeah, Mount Airy, Winston-Salem area.
Forsyth, mm-hmm. Yeah. So Mount Airy is a pretty rural environment. Was there something about your formative years that enabled an environmental ethic that just kept you connected to the land? Or, you know, what was it about your childhood that kind of led to, you know, being interested in being an advocate for the environment?
Well, my family had been involved in agriculture. My great-grandfather was one of the folks that actually blended Lucky Strike and had his own tobacco company in Reidsville, North Carolina. I ended up selling his company to James Buchanan Duke of American Tobacco Company. And back then, it was the old handshake kind of thing. If you'll sell me your company, I'll make sure any of your kids, their kids and grandkids will always have a job. So my grandfather worked for the company. My father worked for the company. And it almost seemed like I was heading in that direction to be a tobacco buyer. But knowing all the hard work that went into growing tobacco, back in that day, those days, they really didn't use a lot of chemicals. Everything was pretty non-filter even. But it was interesting to see how agriculture was changing. So an appreciation for rural farmers and what they had to go through. My dad was a tobacco buyer. He would buy tobacco from farmers. They would show their appreciation for him and the company buying from them by bringing us country hams, things like that. So nice relationship back in those days.
I have a very similar story from my family on kind of both sides of my family. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a buyer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He was born in Roxborough.
Okay.
And worked for American Tobacco Company and Virginia Tobacco Company in Danville. And they probably knew each other.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they did.
Yeah. And then on my mom's side, they grew tobacco on a farm in Edgecombe County outside of Rocky Mount. And that's where I spent a lot of my time really just wandering the woods. And I think that had a profound impact on me growing up. So you mentioned before pesticides and herbicides and fungicides, before what they called the Green Revolution. And now our Green Revolution is more about energy and sustainability. You know, back then it was about trying to grow food more efficiently and feed the world.
Exactly.
I'm fascinated to talk about your experience in the late 70s and early 80s because of the cyclical nature of the work that we do. There are so many things that we could be doing today that we aren't, that you all were talking about, you know, then the late 70s and early 80s. appropriate technology, energy efficiency, community energy, and, you know, community scale energy systems and food systems. Could you speak a little bit about that experience then as a young professional and really what you think we could be learning from today with our current problems that we're needing to solve?
Yeah, you know, my first job out of graduate school in 75 was working for the State Economic Opportunity Office of North Carolina in Raleigh. And they were the state level of the 35 local community action agencies, like WAMI, Watauga Avery Mitchell Yancey Community Action. We'd received a grant from Office of Economic Opportunity, OEO, or Community Services Administration back in the 70s, to do a low-income weatherization program of weatherizing homes. Well, at that time, there had never been a program like that, so this was all pretty novel. So how do you do it? So we had a grant for labor, so we were able to hire people to do it that worked for the community action agencies, but then we had to come up with standards as to how much do you do, what do you do, how much can you spend, what kind of impact does it have, or are we just making it airtight or tighter? Are we putting in new windows and doors? Are we putting in insulation? And back then, in the 70s, just like in the 60s, a lot of the housing stock of low-income folks was pretty bad. If they owned it, it was a little better, but a lot of it was renter-occupied. Just designing those programs, trying to decide who got the most money, I had to come up with a formula of things like poverty rate, owner-occupied degree days of how cold and hot it is in certain areas. So a lot of the community action agencies in the western part of the state got more money because we were factoring in that you need to make a house warmer in the winter better than you need to make it cooler in the summer, because a lot of the houses in eastern North Carolina back then did not have air conditioning by any means. Designing that program, doing the training, we decided to buy cellulose insulation blowing machines. And I had a contract with a company in Northern Virginia that oftentimes they would come down, bring the insulation to us, and we would ship back reams of newspaper. We ended up getting into a little bit of renewables, making wood stoves, things of that sort out of barrels, solar window units that would bring in warm air on the south side of a structure. And it was about that time that this group, also funded by the Community Services Administration, who had funded our low-income weatherization program, was created in Butte, Montana, called the National Center for Appropriate Technology. It was designed after a similar group in England called the Intermediate Technology Center that was started by E.F. Schumacher, who had written this book in the 70s called Small is Beautiful: Economics as If People Mattered. He started this group that was doing village technology in places like India, Pakistan, other places. They were bringing in technology that just really didn't work, or if it worked for a while, if it went down, you couldn't repair it. So trying to come up with ideas as to how to do better farming techniques and things of that sort. The center was located in Butte, Montana. Senator Mike Mansfield, that was sort of his parting gift as he left the Senate. He used to be head of the Senate back in those days. Nobody now remembers him, but they had a great facility, had a $3 million budget, which was big time back then, $1 million for staffing and administration, $1 million for research, and $1 million for grants. I ended up going to work for them after a couple of years with the low-income weatherization program, and was their Appalachian bioregional representative. I moved back up to Radford, Virginia, where I'd gone to graduate school at Virginia Tech, and worked Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, all that whole Appalachian region, traveling around 4 days out of each week, visiting folks, making presentations on the grant program, getting people to line up to do things. Did that for a few years. Then moved on to Tennessee Valley Authority, where I started an appropriate technology program there and also a community energy branch. And that was a lot of fun. We had money to give away, too, as long as you only did one project. You couldn't, like, start a program that you had to consistently fund that particular thing. One of the projects we did in the community energy branch was to fund four communities to do energy assessments and energy projects. One was in Tupelo, Mississippi. One was in Norris, Tennessee, just outside Knoxville. We also had one in Alabama, and we also had one in North Carolina, Boone. And at the time, Appalachian State had a program here called Earth Studies Program in a building not far from where we are right now. And they had a three-person board of directors that was the chancellor of the university at the time, John Thomas, the chairman of the county commissioners, and the district manager for Blue Ridge Electric. And the three of them, along with the local person that had been hired for that, Mike Epley, were doing a lot of things. They had a few faculty members here, like Harvard Ayers, who was doing some things in microhydro. They built a few microhydro installations. When we talk micro, we're really talking pretty small, you know, just really a creek that's being dammed up and a pipe coming out of it, going maybe 100 yards down the hillside at a slight elevation change and then dropping it real rapidly down to the bottom of the creek again, where you might have a small turbine of sorts, not much bigger than a lawnmower engine, that would run and generate some electricity. Those were the early days of microhydro, and actually Appalachian State did a lot in that area in the 70s and 80s. That's also in the early 80s when the windmill was here. TVA did some work with NASA on that, as we were all over here during the dedication of that back in about 1979-80. Of course, the World's Fair was in Knoxville in 82, and the theme of that fair was energy. So all the countries from around the world, this is sort of the last of the great World's Fair. After that, I think there was one more in New Orleans on water. But after that, people realized that Disney World and Epcot Center and all that pretty much had that covered. And we're going to do that on a permanent basis, so no more need for World's Fairs. But countries like China, Australia, and others came in and showed off all their innovative energy programs and technologies. And that was a lot of fun back then, watching that come in and being exposed to that. And also working at Tennessee Valley, we got to do a lot. We brought in George McRobey, who had been E.F. Schumacher's partner at the Appropriate Technology Center, and had him look at projects that we were doing at TVA right after Three Mile Island, where one of the nuclear plants in Pennsylvania sort of went awry. There was a lot of money out there then after that for anything solar. And TVA at the time, under the leadership of Dave Freeman, decided that we need to shut down a lot of this nuclear program and move toward renewables and conservation. And so it was a real big strategy to how can we come up with solar? What was the solar technology at that time? Solar water heating was the most popular aspect. Wood stoves, how do you improve the technology of wood stoves with things like catalytic combustors inside the chimney of the wood stove that would burn the particulates better than the old style, then conservation programs, home weatherization. It was great seeing those programs being generated and how do you work. And we had this one guy come in from New Mexico, Bill Yonda, who came up with the whole idea of solar greenhouses. Having a greenhouse on the south side of your house where you could store the heat during the day, grow vegetables, and get fresh air as well off these greenhouses. We did programs where we actually went to a community and would build a greenhouse over a weekend. The creative days of doing things back then, before the internet, before computers, based on word of mouth, based on actual experience, based on getting on the phone and calling somebody, saying, can you send me some of those plans as to what you were doing? And TVA really had a great lead role in doing that. But like any federal agency, I was there for 10 years. I went through a lot of changes. Reorganizations were real popular back in the 70s and 80s. And I'd always had as my career path, do as many local projects as you can at the state level, at the federal level, and then take that experience and try to apply it to a community where you're going to be there for the long term. We had the opportunity with Blue Ridge Electric back in those days, and Blue Ridge Energy now, to help them write a job description in economic development and sustainable development. I helped them write that description. 6 months later, they got it approved. 6 months later, they called me asking if I knew anybody might be interested. Could I help them with that? I was thinking about it and thought, good time to move back to North Carolina and work at the local level. and came here in 1988. So worked with Blue Ridge Energy for 25 years doing a variety of projects. I was sort of the only person doing that type of thing for them. So it was great to be able to apply those that experience in local areas with a whole variety of projects over that 25-year period.
I have a ton of questions.
All right.
After that. That was terrific. So I'm going to go back to David Freeman. You know, at the time, it seemed like we didn't have battery storage. Thinking about photovoltaics, solar energy at scale was next to impossible.
Right.
So the focus was more decentralized at the community mm-hmm. level, at the user level.
Right.
So that makes sense. So I'm focusing on energy conservation, solar thermal. And that's when we saw, the installation of a lot of these wood boilers and solar thermal, mm-hmm. like the Carolina water stoves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You still see a few of those around.
You do see those. So another question, going back to the Center for Appropriate Technology, when you're doing that work in Southwest Virginia, you're working with homeowners, farmers, mm-hmm. I take it. What are some of those projects? I mean, were they small solar thermal, like you said? Were they more efficient wood stoves?
Just little curious. Of that, we would work with a community action agency who wanted to build the solar window boxes and come up with that design and provide them funds to, say, build 10 of them. And then same thing with the old wood stoves that were made out of barrels, where you had a barrel that was horizontal. You'd put legs on it, get it off the ground, a front cover to it. And then where the chimney came out the back, it would then go into another barrel and then circulate that heat from the exhaust or the smoke and gather it before it went out the final chimney out of the house. So barrels were almost like now, fairly cheap to do, so it just required some welding and a good design. So we came up with some designs that could be passed out and printed, same thing with the window boxes, and we had our folks up in Butte, Montana work on that and figure that type of thing out, come up with some conservation techniques. Ultimately, they end up being the agency that evaluated a lot of the weatherization programs around the country and have done that for decades, working with Department of Agriculture and others to try to determine what's the best way to do home weatherization in a home that's in potentially pretty poor shape to begin with, what's most important. And over time, it was not just air infiltration and weatherization, but actually replacing heating and cooling systems and even, you know, additions to houses and so forth. So that program's really changed over the last 40 years when you look at it for the better.
The window boxes, were they vertical on an angle like a solar thermal flat plate collector without the water lines?
Exactly.
Yep.
You'd have a space behind generally just a almost a piece of tin or some type of metal that would store the heat. And then underneath would be an open space where air would come into it. And then at the bottom of the unit, flow back over the black metal with either glass, sometimes plexiglass, but oftentimes it was just an old window or something else that would try to make it somewhat airtight. And then as it goes into the bottom half of a window, the heat would come in at the top part, and then you would try to have colder air from the floor of the house come in. So it was just a sort of a passive non-fan type activity. Even now, every now and then I'll be riding around the back roads, I'll see something like that out there on a house. It's pretty interesting to see.
I think it would blow the minds of an appraiser or a realtor trying to sell a house if they see those, you know, sticking out the windows, but the functionality is really legitimate. I know they work well. Let me ask you about Chancellor Thomas, John Thomas, and his involvement with this committee and the Earth Studies program. Now, this is making sense now because John Thomas used to always show up to a lot of my talks.
Yeah.
He's always been interested in sustainability mm-hmm. and I think tracked it more closely than I ever realized when he was still alive. And just a really sweet man. He was a great leader for our university.
Oh, yeah. And so, he was an engineer, too.
I know. That's right. He was an engineer, and a lot of people don't remember that. He and others were involved with the early beginnings of the Earth Studies program here at App State that eventually evolved into a few programs, our appropriate technology
exactly.
and sustainable development. They kind of went, you know, different paths. What else do you remember about those early days?
One of them was in agriculture. There was a guy with the program who was into French intensive gardening. they had an appropriate technology farm. You go up into Valley Crucis, go up
194 near Matney, right?
And it was up near Matney, and it had a house up there. Some students lived there for a while. But they had this guy, and I'm trying to think of his name. It'll come to me soon. He's still around. He taught this bio-intensive gardening method. You would come in and put a spade into the ground and do just one turn and then go completely through your flower bed that way. But they had a passive solar collector there made out of concrete blocks filled with sand and facing south, of course, just doing a lot of agriculture in some ways, much like the current Earth Studies farm or whatever we want to call it out in Ashe County, you know, because they're growing food and bringing it in and being served here in the university. So, yeah, when you think back on some of these programs, they've gone through lots of changes over the last 40 years, but in reality, they keep current with the times.
There seems to be a common thread that they're very hands-on, grassroots, a lot of low-tech, appropriate technology. However, they're using high-tech data analytics and some other technology that we have at our disposal now.
Yeah, well, one of the projects we did at Blue Ridge Electric and provided some funding for the county was this methane collector out at the landfill. And that was just 15 years ago. After they closed that landfill, there was still gas to be collected, and they were flaring it off because they didn't want it to go into the atmosphere. But it was determined that you could take that gas and run it through a generator. Now, the big landfills for places like Hickory has one. It's a big, big diesel generator, you know, fits inside the back of a semi. But the one we have out at the Watauga County landfill that's closed is a modified truck engine. They were using those at coal mines in West Virginia, and we decided, let's give it a try. So I think they've got three small truck-type engines, and they provide a little electricity that goes back on the grid, and we ended up making that whole landfill area of buildings a microgrid. So there's 1 meter as the power comes in, and we allow them to use the lines that were out there so they can circulate whatever power they generate off that generator into the rest of the buildings out there, which is not significant, but it's still unique and a great learning experience.
Yeah, exactly. And it's closing the loop on, you know, a waste stream, right? Speaking of waste, I was reading in the materials that you sent over to me early this morning about your experience at TVA with waste reduction and recycling. And I really honed in on the fact that you're involved with inventing the convenience center.
Yeah.
That fascinates me. I'd love for you to expand on that a little bit.
Well, back in the day, and I'll just use Watauga as example, counties did not do door-to-door waste collection. Only municipalities did that. But obviously, there's a lot of waste being generated out there in the houses that are around a county. Oftentimes, people would have their own barrel in the backyard and take their waste out there and burn it. And of course, that's not very environmentally appropriate. The second phase past that, counties would establish what they call green box sites. They would consolidate somewhere between 5 and 8, maybe 10 green boxes, containers for garbage on the side of the road, drive by, throw your garbage in there, and go on. Well, those sites, the garbage, somebody might catch it on fire or put ashes in there that would cause a fire. They were exposed to the weather. They would rust. Vermin, rats, bears, everything got into it. There would be scavengers or dumpster divers out there. So potholes, glass, you were taking your car and yourself a little risk just by disposing of garbage that way. And there would be, like in Watauga County, anywhere from 30 to 50 sites like that around the county. The trucks would have to go out there and lift up the boxes, put them in the back of the garbage truck. Of course, they didn't know what was in there. So oftentimes it could already be on fire. They'd be throwing it into the back of a $200,000 truck and have to go down the road. As the air went in, the fire gets bigger, and they'd have to stop and dump the whole load on the side of the road. It was just not a good system, and we came up with an idea of let's consolidate it, let's fence it in, let's have a person out there, let's have certain hours of operation. Just like now, I know that Thursday morning is my garbage pickup day, and I have to get my two rolling garbage cans out to the curb. So you know, here's the days that it's open, here's the days that it's closed. There will be an attendant out there maybe to help elderly people to do that. So we came up with a book of different designs on how you do it and what are the best locations. And initially, there was some resistance to that. People didn't want them near their home or their neighborhood. But once they saw how clean they were, it was a welcome addition. I guess we have 5 or 7 sites here in Watauga, and they're all fenced in. One problem we have is people who are Airbnb-type folks. They'll go there and as they're leaving town on a late evening, like a Sunday, and they'll just put their garbage out by the front gate. Usually the attendant will go through that to see if they can get a name that they can send a ticket to. But for the most part, it still works very well.
So this was primarily for health and safety, trying to get people to stop burning garbage, throwing it in rivers, down ravines,
exactly,
and that sort of thing, right? Was TVA involved with kind of the early days of also recycling, try to divert certain things, like aluminum probably first?
Yeah. You know, back then you also had jails that had prisoners. They needed to help them do something. They used prisoners in a lot of small counties to do roadside pickup. Mm. And as they were doing that, they were also realizing, we've got a lot of aluminum here or glass that could be recycled. Let's come up with programs for that. We came over here and provided 2 grants, one to the town for recycling and one to the county for the convenience centers. Ultimately, both of them came up with very good programs that over the years have been improved dramatically, where we have curbside recycling in Boone now and a lot of recycling opportunities in the county, including the convenience centers. Yeah, back then we were doing a variety of programs. And when I came here initially to Watauga, they had a bond issue that had been associated with the hospital that had been finished, and they got some money back, and they used this $2 million to establish a program to do baling of garbage at the Watauga County landfill. And they built a facility with those funds and put a baler in there. And this is a baler that you have a concrete floor and you move the garbage around on the floor in front of it and mix it together and then put it on this conveyor belt that goes up and then drops it into this bin. And then a hydraulic press compacts it into a bale about the size of a table, 30 by 60 by 30, and wraps it with wires. And then you pick the bale up that weighs somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 pounds with a front-end loader and put it on the back of a flatbed truck. Flatbed truck goes to what is now called the bale fill and stacks them up. And then you cover up the face or the top of the bale fill each day and then come back and start again the next day. And so the landfill here, actually, I guess the last 2 years of its operation was a true bale fill. Some law came up from the state that allowed them to get out of the landfill business and avoid a lot of future liability. And as it turns out, they're just saying counties under a certain size of almost 100,000, it doesn't pay to have a landfill. You need to do a regional landfill. And that's what we do now. We have a tipping station at the landfill. You tip it on the floor. They don't bale it, although I think that would still be a nice way to compact it. It's certainly much more efficient than running a large compactor back and forth over garbage. But I guess we're shipping our garbage either to East Tennessee or down to Caldwell County outside of Lenoir. So I guess we send about 5 loads of garbage down there every day when the landfill is operating.
So let's talk about now and the future. You know, really interested in what you think is a very promising kind of off-the-shelf technology that can help us with our urgent need to decarbonize, fight against climate change, and looking to the future, what do you think is emerging that might be very promising? Not that it's ever going to be a silver bullet of energy, but, you know, what are you tracking?
Well, I remember when photovoltaics first came out, we used to say something, by the mid-1990s, photovoltaics will be everywhere, on top of phone poles and utility lines and things of this sort. They'll be so cheap and available that they'll be everywhere, and that electricity will then become almost totally decentralized. No need for central station power plants anymore. Well, that's 25 years ago now. It didn't happen, but a lot of that technology has happened in the last 20 years. It just didn't get the push back then that it needed. But I think if you look back at the last 40 years, every 5 or 10 years got a bump of some sort, an improvement in the technology, whether it was in solar panels, photovoltaic panels, or improvements in the battery storage technology. I know in the early 2000s, I was working on some projects where we thought fuel cells would be the new thing, where you're taking natural gas or propane, breaking it up and turning it into hydrogen, electricity, and water. I think that still has some potential, but I think that's in the next 25 to 30 years. I think right now photovoltaics, battery technology are going to be the real thing that we see. People really like electric vehicles, the fact that they can be charged with photovoltaics, the fact that they can be a battery for the grid itself, the cars and vehicles, and the fact that photovoltaics are really coming down in price. I think all of that's tied together. I never thought that transportation would necessarily be the push that made a lot of that happen. But with privatized space exploration and rockets, a lot of stuff going on there in types of photovoltaics, very thin type of PV worked into roofing panels, into windows, into all types of siding on the tops of cars. You know, it's pretty amazing. You know, the Rose car that you guys have here at ASU, a very thin type of PV, not cheap, very expensive. How do you take that technology and make it affordable? When that type of thing happens where it's you buy a roofing system and PV is built into it. We've had, over the last 40 years, a lot of solar home tours here in the county. We've gone out to look at a lot of these innovative systems. I remember somebody had what they call a standing seam roof, which is a type of metal roof with a seam that sticks up about 2.5 inches. And the company that sold it to them had a type of, it was actually like PV on a roll that went between the standing seam. It was pretty amazing. They were able to reduce the cost of their roof by almost half because the rest of the PV panel got tax credits at the time. I'm not too sure that was the best use of that technology. And the plastic over time was like a lot of plastics, degrades and reduced the efficiency. But even if it had a 10 or 15 year life, helped with the learning curve, if nothing else. Yeah.
We'll have time for one more question. You touched on some community events like the Solar Home Tour.
Yeah.
I know you've been very involved with the Green Drinks effort here the High Country. Could you speak to its origin and what you're doing today?
Yeah, Green Drinks International is a group that sort of said, we're going to save our society one drink at a time. Social networking, a lot like networking on Facebook and other types of things, where a great way to meet people is oftentimes in a bar or a bar type setting where you're having drinks and you're just talking back and forth like we are now, asking questions. What do you think about this and that? So we have a group that 10 years ago we met for about a 5-year period, almost once a month, usually on a Tuesday or Wednesday night from say 5:30 to 7:30 in a restaurant on an off night so that it was beneficial to them. They oftentimes would provide the appetizers and a drink special. Oftentimes we'd have a topic, but most of the time it was all about socializing. You just came in, put on a name tag, put a little card in the fishbowl, and we'd pull out some door prizes. If you win, you come forward and tell us what you're doing that's green. We quit for about a 10-year period when I first retired, but we had a meeting here, I guess, about a year ago that ASU sponsored with your sustainability program, your appropriate technology program, your programs in business that were looking at sustainability, and said, you know, how can we get more going in this area? How can we get people talking? I volunteered to restart Green Drinks. We've had about 4 meetings over the last year. We had one this week that was a little lightly attended, where we were looking at the new Tesla charging station and the new electric bus from Apple Cart. The first charging station here in Watauga County at Makoto's. The owner of Makoto's 10 years ago had a Tesla, one of the first buyers of the Tesla and put a charging station out front. He's now added a second supercharger in the back so you can go in, have a meal, charge your Tesla, and he pretty much lets you charge it for free if you're having a meal there and go on your way. So we're looking to do some more around the area where we'll look at green projects and just have people get together. We had a great one a couple of months ago at Boonshine, your group here at ASU that did the Rose electric vehicle racing car was the spotlight. We were able to walk over to your garage and see the vehicle and talk to the students who had been involved. That was great for them. We all had a good time and it really felt good. I guess we had close to 45 people there. There are just a lot of good things going on, and it's hard to, you know, with a local newspaper that only comes out once a week, it's hard to find out about them. Getting people together just to socialize, talk about green, you don't have to have an alcoholic drink to participate, and you'll meet some interesting people. I was surprised at some of the folks that came to that meeting we had at Boonshine. I hadn't seen in 10 years or so, and they're talking about some PV projects in the community, and just a lot of interest, especially with LEED certified buildings here and other things, things that people need to know more about. And how do we address future topics like affordable housing and still transportation issues and waste management, food production and distribution? There's just some great people in this community doing lots of unique things that are part and parcel of the last 40 years that I've been around Boone.
I really enjoyed the green drinks opportunity to, like you said, socialize and just cross-pollinate and learn what's going on.
Meet new people.
Everybody sharing information, ideas, sharing what doesn't work and what does work. And even more than that, I appreciate your being here and your time today.
I'm the old green guy.
Yeah, Brian Crutchfield, the old green guy, the original OG, you know. And I just really appreciate your time here today. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Lee.
Find Your Sustainability is a production of the University Communications Department at Appalachian State. It's hosted by Appalachian's Chief Sustainability Officer, Lee Ball. For more information about Appalachian State sustainability, check out sustain.appstate.edu. For more podcasts, videos, and articles related to Appalachian State, check out today.appstate.edu.